Hey everybody, welcome to today's episode of No Killing Goblins. I'm Oshi, and I'm here with...
Dragoness.
Always a little slow on the uptake on that one.
You know, yeah, that sounds like it. I'm slow on the uptake on Sundays most of the time, and we record on Sundays, so I'm just slow.
Well, it's not my fault. We record on Sundays. You're the one who has a different, difficult and D&D heavy schedule.
Oh, it's not just the D&D. Honestly, mostly, I have the energy to do kind of like one big thing a day, and for most days, that's work.
That is a very fair thing, because I'm generally in the same boat. I can't stop working, because I know the second I stop, I'll just, like, keel over, and that'll be the end of the day for me. My mind cannot deal with more than three consecutive conversations, either. This is so stupid. Okay.
No, I get what you mean. And honestly, it's been kicking my butt recently trying to do these online classes. I haven't even had time to read. I have no book. I have been just completely, like, I've been so boring this week.
I don't want to talk about a book, but I have to talk about this book. Not every book is the top of the top of the tippy top.
Yeah.
Sometimes I read things because I kind of just want to chill. Also because I want to make fun of it. Also because I love romance. So there's a book by Helen Huang named The Kiss Quotient. So this is a very typical romantic book. Let's go off that. But it was interesting because, one, the writer is Asian. And it's done from the perspective of an Asian woman. And it was interesting. And it wasn't the typical bullshit that I expected it. I liked it. I enjoyed it. Helen Huang does write very well within the romance genre. If you are a romance person. And yes, I do read one book a week at least to make sure before I do this shit. And I enjoyed it. I also picked up the latest chapters of Pale. I've been waiting until Pale hit 10 chapters, and Pale is by Eric, etc. And he finished Practical Guide to Evil a while back. EE. So EE finished Practical Guide a while back, and it is, I think we can talk about this publicly now because they announced it. So it's going to be on the Yonder app, which is also going to be where Gravesong is released. So that's pretty cool. If you're interested, just Google Yonder app. I don't think you can download it quite yet, but it's going to be an app sort of like the Webtoons app where you just go on your phone and you read stuff and you pay little coins to get ahead and all that stuff, and you get free markers every week. Whatever. If you've ever been to a Webtoon scene, you know it.
Yeah. I'm interested in seeing if they've gone through, like, the full editing path, you know, from beginning to end on a Practical Guide, or if they're editing it as they try and, like, put it up onto Yonder, because I think it's also going to do sort of like the weekly release setup they have for Webtoon. It'll be interesting. I've been holding off on Pale Lights because I'm still just a little bit...
burned?
I know, burned's not the right word.
We've talked about pre-GTE before. Practical Guide is just...
And we've even talked about how it's so divisive even between us that we tried to record an episode and it just turned into us screaming at each other and we couldn't release it. I think it's really well written, but I hate everything it stands for. That's a really strange place to try and recommend a piece of media from. But I do recommend it.
I do recommend it as well. There are some problems with some of the books, like pieces of the book that I don't agree with, and not in the content place that Dragoness is coming from, but literally from the structural spot. It isn't even I would do things differently, it's just the way you did it. It felt bad, it made me feel bad, it made me not want to read it. I tried to go back to it and it was not good for me. Like,
yeah, there is a really clear, like, sort of point before and after where I feel like EE actively changed up what he wanted the story to be, and an editing pass is really needed to help make all that fit.
I agree.
Right around the drow section.
I agree.
But like it's still good, and I'll probably wind up reading Pale Lights because I recommended a friend into Practical Guide and he was wild about it. He's been wild about this, and I'm certain he'll want to talk about it. And since I also got him into Wandering In and made him read all 8 million of those words, I'll probably have to just read Pale.
Yeah, and Practical Guide is, this is not a knock on the writer's ability to produce quality work. EE did a really great job as far as like writing it and putting it together, and I mean it was their work and their baby, and they did the job. Unfortunately, it didn't always work for me, which sucked for me, but not necessarily for everybody else. But I got pushed off the track, which is that I picked up the Pale chapters. They got to chapter 10, so I started reading them. There's another reason I read them. So there's a podcast now for people who follow Practical Guide, and they're covering Pale, I think.
I believe they are, yeah. I've loosely followed that podcast.
Yeah, they've had, I think they have one episode out, and they have a really cool name too. I mean, it's podcast guys talking erratic errata, but that's not the name that got me. It's their Twitter name is The Long Price.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's for those who've not read it, you won't know, but it's epic. I guess they couldn't get it for their podcast name, but it probably would have been too complicated, and there's rights and things like that. So
Yeah.
yeah, I liked it. I haven't actually listened to it, but it prompted me to go and start Pale, and I did. And I've read the first three chapters when he originally released it. Oh my God, like a year and a half ago. So I remember the primary characters, a dude who's like a thief. And I'm not gonna say names and stuff because I 100 million time I'm bad with names. But there is a thief and a very noble woman, and they're in dire straits. To escape their problems, they have to take this trial on an island to join an organization called The Watch. And it's very the start of Dragon Age-y, but the world itself is vastly different. Seems to be centered around a literal interpretation of points of light. If anybody remembers what that means, it means that there's these cities and things that have literally exist in these safe havens where there is light, and then the rest of the world is in darkness. And there's a lot of complexity to it. There's a lot. The world is, by the way, is called Vesper.
Yeah.
It's built on the ruins of an old one in a dark, colossal cavern no one has ever known the edges of. So, and that cavern encompasses oceans, islands, whole plains. So we're talking Underdark level here, for those who are D&D players.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of that of Blades in the Dark. Like both of them have that sort of Lovecraftian Renaissance feel to them. And if anybody's familiar with the Blades in the Dark RPG, it's good. You get what I mean. If you're not, you should play it. It's very fun. I'll run a game of it. Don't dare me not to.
And so far, it's dense in terminology, and there's a lot of characters. So those people who like get annoyed because there are too many characters in one chapter of The Wandering In, don't. You're gonna get annoyed too. But if you can get past that and let yourself feel the ride a little bit, it is fairly good. I hesitate to say this because I don't like this particular critique because I think it's kind of small, but there it feels familiar, but not in like it feels like a little bit of a retread.
Retread of.
Characters in peril go across the waters to join an organization, and they must survive the trials that await them while stymieing the betrayal and brutality of the contest that allows them to do all this stuff. Remind you of anything?
Reminds me of a few things.
Yeah, and also of PGTE a little bit. And that's okay that you want some resonance between one book and another, and there has to be something there. But and the world is very well developed from what I can tell. EE is very confident in the way they use the set pieces that exist in the world, the terminology, the way things work. They definitely drew a lot from, I think, Spanish language and I don't even know how to call it, like Aztec stuff. At least from my perspective, I could be wrong. I didn't really do anything other than purchase the Patreon and read up to the latest chapter. Yeah, so there's 10 chapters available for free, and he releases one a week. And I believe if you buy the Patreon, you get 3 chapters ahead as well. It's pretty good. And that's where I'm at right now. I'm not committed to it, but I do enjoy the backstabbing and conspiracy stuff, which is what I loved PEE's earlier work for. So I guess this is where we're at.
Yeah, and I've only gotten about 2 chapters in. I will catch up eventually. That said, if I ever find myself with a spare few dollars for a Patreon, it's immediately going over to the Beware of Chicken Patreon.
You should, dude. Casual Farmer's on a break, so I'm not gonna talk about it. But I know what you don't. I know a lot of things.
Fuck off. And honestly, the thing that holds me back, and this is not just an issue with, this is an issue with every Royal Road story. I hate having to go read the fucking story on Patreon. I hate having to go and download a PDF or having to go and read it in like the Patreon. It's miserable, it's unpleasant, I just can't.
This is why I enjoy the fact that Pirate has produced their own website and made its, even though it has plenty of problems, and it looks like somebody created it in 1998, and it could so much be improved.
WordPress is WordPress is WordPress. And honestly, I think a lot of people, once they reach a certain size, would benefit from having their own site where they could, do more and customize it to fit their exact needs and make it easier for Patreon rewards to tie into like the main way that you're reading instead of having to go through other shit. Like, slowly but surely, if you look at the TWI website too, you'll notice that, like, that top bar continues to grow with crazy, fun, different little stuff getting added on. Like, you can't do that on Royal Road.
Yeah, you're right. And but the thing is, it also requires a level of dedication and hoping that your audience follows you off of Railroad, and you have to produce a site that's readable and workable. Like, Casual Farmer just literally does not have the time to build a website. I don't know if he's ever going to produce one. He's talked about it, like doing a website, but he's writing every day of the week. This is one of the reasons why I'm like, as soon as you can afford one, get an assistant or get somebody to help you, even if it's just your cousin.
Yeah, and like I imagine you could pay somebody to put a cheap workable site together. But yeah, I definitely wouldn't recommend it for people that didn't have like I think if you're at the point where you've got like say your audiobook and your Amazon book out and they do well, that's when I think you should consider moving because that means that your people are willing to follow you to non-railroad stuff. Before that, I think that it's distinctly risky and probably not worth it.
I mean, that's why the Yonder app is trying what it is, right? Because they think they can produce a more interact, like none of these like independent writers and Royal Road are able to produce that kind of, they don't have that much money behind them. Webtoon has a fuck ton of money. So they're putting a lot of money behind the physical, like the app. And if it works out, that's exactly what they're trying to do, producing a comfortable place to read, right?
Royal Road leaves a lot of money on the table by not having some way to run like donation payments behind chapters that are locked on Royal Road. Like that, I realize that that is a big like thing to set up and is very complicated and is very difficult, but it's a lot of money on the table.
I'm not sure it is difficult. It's just a matter of having the funds to pay for the development, right? You have to build the infrastructure from a web-based point of view, and then you have to hook that all up to the financial infrastructure, and then you have to secure all of that information, because if you create any kind of web-based infrastructure, you have to secure people's money, or you have to get big institutions to secure it for you.
Apparently, they already have some sort of payment system in place because they have a premium, which I didn't know. I don't really read Royal Road stuff. I just literally hopped onto Royal Road, saw a premium at the top, and said, "Oh, they already have like the infrastructure in place for payments and stuff like that."
Yeah, the payments are relatively easy to do. It's like the building the app, that's the thing. You don't just build it, you have to maintain it. This is at the base minimum, three people on the level of number of people who visit that website. If you're getting like 300,000-400,000 people visiting your website and they want to interact with it, you have to build something that won't instantly break when all 400,000 of them are loaded on their phone.
I wasn't even thinking an app. Like Railroad's browser-based as is like, I don't know if they have an app or not. I assume that they would.
I mean, the app is where the money is, right? Because once you have an app, you can like host it and like it's a whole thing. I don't want to talk about this anymore. I don't like this. It's where reading is going, and honestly, if there was a, I'm not necessarily fan run, but certainly a vendor specific like for the writers kind of thing, I would be all for it. But it's all gonna be corporate chains, and they are all gonna be like trying to replicate what the big five trade publishers do, which is effectively control everything and give you nothing. So they're essentially replicating webtoons, and I'm not sure I'm very happy about that, but if it means money for the writers, it is what it is.
Yeah, and like Webtoon is some like okay, I have such mixed feelings on Webtoon.
I'm in the same boat, man.
And like I think they do so much right, but they also piss me off. And I recently was forced to suddenly change phones. I went from Apple to Android, and now I have like a fuck ton of those coins that won't transfer over. But I hate reading on my iPad. I don't know why. It's weird. Like, I don't know, I'm just annoyed.
Wait, they make it app specific, not account specific?
So basically the stuff that I buy on the Apple store does not transfer over. This is true of everything. Like I had to rebuy several apps that I had already bought before. Like the Cyberpunk Red app that runs the a bunch of shit for me while I'm running Cyberpunk. I had to rebuy the premium for that for $5. Just different stores. I do enjoy talking about like the future of the publishing stuff and how it's looking, and I think Yonder is an interesting step in like trying to bring the same kind of real official acknowledgement and monetization that we're getting with webcomics now through stuff like Webtoon. Whereas previously you just had to like
It's not web comics. Let's be clear. What they're finally doing is recognizing that there is an actual amount of people who read manga and manhwa and whatever the hell the Chinese version of it is, Chinese manga. They read all of this stuff and that it sells and that you could turn it into TV series and that yes, it's worth paying pennies on the dollar to make these starving artists draw all of this stuff and then buy the media rights if it turns out that it works. Because that's what they do in Japan and in Korea and stuff, right? They turn all the webtoon stuff into K-dramas and J-dramas and manga, sorry, and animes.
some, the ones that like really make it. In particular, oh God, what's his name? The guy that did Sweet Home. He also did Shotgun Boy, which is great, and that's something I need to pitch sometime because the premise of Shotgun Boy and what Shotgun Boy actually is sound very different from each other in a funny way.
The other aspect of this is I actually read the press release for Yonder, and they had some, maybe not heavy hitters, but very specific people. One of them was a very famous like webtoons person that they're translating over. I don't know if it's very much translated work. And then the other one was a TikTok famous writer, and the last one was and the next one was like a paranormal romance writer that's very, very famous in like paranormal romance. And then there's pirate. So it's a unique mix of people. And honestly, it's a good cross section of all the internet readers, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're trying to hit the widest swath of people they can. But the other thing is, it's also a lot of people with built-in fan bases. And even if you can't tap into or monetize all of them, like you'll be able to pull people in, and if you can get word of mouth going through those communities and then build up more people, get more people in, you get just one story that breaks through into the mainstream, and now you've got all the eye. Like it's a solid business plan.
And if you're, I don't know if it'll last more than 2 years, but if it does, if it becomes a thing that stands a little bit on its own, it can become a way for a lot of web serial writers to monetize their work in a way that doesn't require them to be on Patreon the whole fucking time, right?
Yeah, which, is at that point you're picking your poison and your evil. But it is what it is. And even if they don't work out, like, somebody else will come into the same space and do it.
I hope so, and I hope that they're better than whatever Yonder ends up. Not better, just they're what everybody hopes that they are. Because, successive, maybe free market actually works out for us once for once. I'm trying to transition into the horns. Let me do it.
I know, but you just tried to transition on a really spicy comment, and I'm biting my tongue over here.
Okay, look, just leave it alone.
I'm biting my tongue. You're the one making a big deal out of this.
So today's episode is supposed to be about the horns. Syria, Springwalker, Pisces, Kissenver of the Free Hive, or formerly of the Free Hive, and Yivlan Byers. Did I get all their names right? Yes, I did.
Yeah, although I'm gonna deeply enjoy saying the word Yvlon repeatedly. I'm gonna mess it up so many times. All of these Y names are evil.
I still can't say her brother's name.
Elas is, yeah, Yvlon's got the easiest of the names.
But we want to talk about the horns today. The horns play a pretty significant character arc within Volume 3. The fact that they reformed is big enough, right? So they basically reform in Volume 2, but this volume is when they actually become a unit. Let's go over their basic arc. So first, they get together as a team. They decide to leave the Wandering Inn and try their hand at Albez, which is a dungeon further away from Lyskor, close to another city. They travel overland, go to this Albez, and dungeon dive. They begin to learn a little bit about each other, become more used to each other's capabilities, and when they get into Albez, it is a fucking, I don't know, it's not a shit show, but it's like what you would expect from a really good adventure, right?
Yeah.
Lots of danger and near death.
It is a creatively designed dungeon trap. Like, just step one, I love the fucking big trap they bump into. But I also love the way that the horns finding their way to that section felt like the kind of creative thinking outside the box bullshit that real D&D players do. We know the rough area we're in. I'm gonna use my necromancer powers and try and raise any skeletons if they happen to be underneath me down there. Oh, it worked? I make them start digging up. Like, that was awesome.
And it wasn't just that. It's the there's a dynamic that starts to flow in the way Kissenver acts and the way Yivlan acts. You can see the subtle interplay of I must protect these people because from different points of view. Like for Kissenver, it's I have no purpose. I was thrown away and these people saved me. I can't let them die. They're all I have. And then from Yivlan, you can see her like PTSD has not left this woman at all.
No.
And even the most minor of things, she sort of overcompensates a little bit. And in this whole messy soup, you have Syria, who's actually probably the most experienced adventurer in that entire group.
Yeah, it got called out way back with the original horns when people were working on what their plan was for the thing was going to be. It's like, Saria's old. She's a half elf. She's got a disproportionately large amount of adventuring experience and just life ex just life experience.
I remember, she was in a village for a long time, and she said it straight up that the village is like very boring, and most of her life experience came after the village.
True.
So I'd say they're equal in maturity, but yes, most of her experiences come from being an adventurer, and I'm pretty sure she can understand the undercurrents and the party dynamics. And there is a level of like, this is all we have that all of them demonstrate. And to elucidate very quickly, they fall into a nightmare insanity trap. I think that trap was like brilliant, right?
Oh yeah, no, that trap is really fun and almost inspiring. I have stolen a few pieces of it for D&D games.
I commend Pirate for coming up with it. And I commend Syria for using her natural resistance to get them the fuck out of it. Like, that's a team captain right there, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a bit of luck and like a combination of interesting factors, which, that to me is something I always love about a good adventure story like that. It isn't just that they were, better than everyone else who's ever made their way to that point in time. It's just they were the ones who were there at the right time and had the right skills for that moment. With Saria's a bit of resistance and like just that ability to come out of it just long enough to throw the mud ball and then go back in and mud ball, go back in. The fact that like a great deal of time and effort had been put into covering all the other ones before they got there. Kissimver's strange sort of like pseudo aberration but built-in resistance, letting him just kind of help her out.
Yeah, and that and the fact that they worked together, the fact that Syria was able to like take a punch and keep on ticking kind of attitude. I mean, I was impressed. I mean, she's been impressive before surviving what happened in the crypts, all of that shit, but this was like true grit kind of leadership, kind of I can do this. And she didn't even use magic, which is probably not good for her class, but really good for, showing the kind of person she is for me. Anyway.
Yeah, it's just that absolute determination underneath all the other fancy stuff, like just the willpower to get back up every single time and just keep trying it.
So she passes from that point into the next one, which is she leads them. I guess she doesn't lead them, she sort of saves them all, and I don't think Pisces or Yvlan expected Syria or Kassimber to be as capable as the two of them. Let's be real, the both of them are a little bit snobby. Pisces for obvious reasons, and Yvlan because, I don't know, she just expects herself to be better than everybody.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't think it's so much that they didn't expect, like, nothing else. Like, we still need to do Wistrum Days, but Pisces knows better. Pisces knows Saria knows her shit.
Yes. And that's why he trusts her, but even so, I don't think he expected Kissimver to be as useful or as effective as he was.
None of them did.
That's the thing, that's what I'm trying to say. Like, there was the quote unquote two least useful members ended up being the ones who saved their asses. So it kind of rebalanced the party a little bit, and then they met what they thought was a jackpot and discovered the first rule of all adventurers. Everything's trapped.
And they even checked for traps, but oh God, it makes me want to cry when I think about what was in that room.
I know, too.
Oh my God, and Pirate had such a beautiful description of everything. Like, you get chills thinking about how powerful and cool all of it would have been. And then.
And then the fire elemental burns it all. And the thing is, I think Pirate knew exactly what they were doing in that chapter, and in spending the time to describe it, because Pirate generally didn't do descriptions until relatively recently, because we forced them to, and because they knew it's better, right? Whatever. But he did this. This was just them going like, "Here's a shiny." Nope.
Here's Shiny.
Yeah, but the reversal of what happens, like what they do recover from Alves, including the door.
Oh, yeah, on the subject of like creative bullshit players would do, I absolutely love them picking up this door and using it as a weapon. It is creative lateral adventure player character thinking of like the highest degree. And I sometimes wonder, like, if they had managed to cover more of the elemental with the door when they got it, if maybe they could have saved some of the stuff. But either way, that door made it, which is impressive.
Exactly.
And as realistic and cool as it is that they then picked up and took the door as loot, I still am a little bit sad that none of them tried to do what players have actually done in a game I did a thing with Symbol of Insanity in high school, where they then attempted to, like, take off the wall a Symbol of Insanity, clean it off without looking at it, wrap it in cloth, and then unveil it towards things you don't like.
I was just about to say that. I felt like the horns were like, they were just willing to take what they got because at that point they were a little bit demoralized. But to be fair, I mean, if they had gone back, they could have completely stripped that dungeon of everything. Because there is nothing in there that is not worth something. Even the traps are worth something. And I found the fact that Pirate emphasized that what we consider loot isn't the only way to get loot was, without even saying those words, was pretty good. It was pretty fucking good. I love that.
Yeah. I don't know how much D&D you play, but I wasn't surprised by that as much myself because I'm used to having to be incredibly careful. You describe the tiniest bit of opulence, right? And then suddenly you have 15 minutes of player characters describing how they're stripping all of the adamantium trim out of a room. You describe a magically enchanted trap, and a player is absolutely attempting to pry that plus one sword out of the wall because that's a free plus one sword.
My thing, though, I do play a lot of D&D. I've met those players. I don't play with those players. I'm sorry. But the thing, I mean, we are sort of like that, but not as bad. But the thing I was gonna, the reason I was like amazed is that a writer took that attitude and put it into a book. Generally speaking, that's not necessarily an attitude that's properly reflected in the books. And it's usually reflected in like player tables because player tables know it's a game. But this isn't a game for them. This is real life.
I think that that rings true, though, and I think that the way player characters do it is more real than the way a lot of fantasy people do it. Like, I don't know what you've done for work in your life, but I've done a lot of, like, furniture installation, landscaping, so on, and there's a lot of jobs where it's like, okay, we have to break down all these old cubicles, and you go to throw them out, and then you're immediately throwing them back into your truck because, like, they've got a bunch of copper in them. Like, when your adventurers are in very real way, like working class, I'm gonna take every scrap out of this I can, and you learn how to do that when that's like your life. That's way more real to me than a lot of the like traditional fantasy depictions.
Yep, I agree. Okay, so concerning the next part of, I mean, the next part is they finally get celebrated as adventurers, and you immediately find out that towns can drain your pocket. I mean, even Kissenberg gets, who is the scary black tie Dantinium that everybody thinks is a monster, gets treated with a general level of respect, and then they flee the city before they lose all the money they make and end up in Selim, where three of the most significant things in the volume happen. One, they tell the story of what happened at Wistrum between Syria and Pisces. Two, they decide what to do with Torin once Eren explains how she let him go and what he's done in Estelm, because they were able to cross Estelm and found out all about the horrible things that Torin did. And then they recover the door because they abandoned it the first time, but they recover the door and use it to get back to L'Skor with Eren. That's essentially what happens with the horns for Volume 3, yes?
Pretty much, although God, you just said Esselman, I got like that is probably my personal favorite mini arc in this. I can't wait till we talk about it. That is where we meet Ivlaunt, by the way, in this volume. Just to confirm for you.
Yes.
And I am just so like something I think is interesting about like that confluence of events where they're all meeting up though is Pisces sort of realizing that he's done it, but realizing that now is really not the time to brag about it. And that stands out as a significant character moment to me because Pisces is the kind of person that if you were to just have, incidentally confirmed to him that he did in fact do it, he made it, it's there, and then he doesn't brag about it.
More than that, I know the materials, he doesn't have necessarily the materials, but he doesn't start immediately, like, he doesn't leave the group and immediately start finding ways to experiment so he can create more of them. I think there was a couple of moments that have shaken Pisces. Meeting Eren and the way she deals with things was one of them. But I think Albez and what happens with the horns and how they treat him is the other one. And the internal arc he goes through in Volume 3, where he finally, I don't know if he's completely committed, but he truly does start, like, trusting the horns in a way that, and I say the horns to mean Syria, Yavlon, and Kissimer. He trusts them in a way that I don't think he quite has in a long time trusted a lot of people.
Yeah, it isn't just like the trust he's placing in them. He's acknowledging the trust that they're placing in him when he starts trying to train and get back in form. But it's also it's this wake up call, because like, one of I think the persistent jokes about Pisces in my brain is that the tragic thing about Pisces is he is actually as good as he thinks he is. But, and this is the big problem, he has fallen so far from who he was at Wistrum. What Pisces, Saria directly calls him out for him. The Pisces she knew in Wistrum would have had the footwork and the skills to simply just not have to fuck with that elemental. He could have run circles around it. But instead, he's kind of turned into a layabout vandal who spooks people for money and robs them.
Not to dip too far into the Wistrum stories, because we're going to have an episode about it, but he's become what Wistrum wanted him to.
Yeah, and I think his realization that he has in his mind an image of who he could be, but that's not who he is. And it's the trust that these people are putting into him and the wake-up call for it that sort of gives him that drive to be there and improve again. And I think it's really interesting. And yeah, now that I think about it, it is kind of weird that he did not at least like try and well, you know what? I just realized that he might not. Oh my god. Did he realize Torin could level, or was it just that Torin was self-aware?
Both. Torin is self-aware, and his self-awareness had to have come from, I mean, sorry, let me take that back. So he was designed to grow more powerful. The only way he could grow more powerful is if he leveled.
Maybe. But it's interesting. This is something I might have to dissect because I've realized it's not clear if Pisces know he made leveling undead or if he just made sentient undead. Because there's historical precedent with golems and all of that that I won't get into.
Regardless, that and his encounter with Terriark.
Oh, yeah. No, Eldavin humbling them. Like, he just kind of hops out and he's like, okay, don't mind if I proceed to, like, completely body all of you with a couple cantrips and a first level spell.
And then I sit there and immediately teach you something that you should know. And why are you trying to learn really powerful spells? Why are you not just using the basics? Like, he teaches them in a second more than they probably learned ever in Wistrum.
I don't know if it was more than they ever learned at Wistrum, but it's one of those things that it's really interesting that Wistrum does not apparently seem to be teaching, right? Like, it really captures just how.
Yeah, how far magic has fallen, right?
Yeah. And also, I really love that all of this was because he needed help working the smartphone. Didn't realize there was more than one page. Like, just swipe right and there's a whole new set of apps.
Okay. I guess we talked about Pisces and his growth. We talked about Syria and her coming into her determination to rebuild the horns. I suppose we should engage a little bit with Yvonne and Kissimber as well. Kissimber is.
Poor Yvonne.
I'm not even. Let's not touch Yvonne until the end because that's a whole thing. But Kissimber is another Antinium that I just ended up loving so much. Despite everybody else's, like, deep hatred for what he did to Pawn and how he acted from the early chapters, I was like, oh, he's a little shit. I wonder why. And then the more you get to learn about Kissimber in this volume, the way he calls Pisces comrade Pisces, and like the way he treats Syria, the way he treats Yvonne, the way he learns, and his internal monologue, and the fact that he can annoy Pisces, which is.
Oh, yeah.
It takes a lot.
Oh, it's very easy to annoy Pisces, but the way that he can just do it so effortlessly, it's hard for me to like.
He's guileless. That's the thing.
Yeah, he's just so innocent. And that's sort of the thing with him and what happened with Pawn. After this, and as time goes on, I increasingly lay blame for that both on like the queen and the fucked up system that the Antinium live under. Because at the end of the day, he's like a fucking 1 year old. I realize that he's not actually 1 year old, but for all of like his life experience, kid's an infant at that point when he's dealing with Pawn.
Yeah.
And
And he's just so earnest in his desire to matter, I guess. Is that the right way to say it?
So basically, every ounce of value that and self-worth that he had was tied up in the hive and his place within it. And then he had no place within it anymore. And these people reach out to him and say, "Hey, we will offer you a place here." And I think that he is just so determined to earn that in like a way that he doesn't even really need to earn it, you know?
Yeah, but it's his journey, right? He doesn't need to earn it, but at the same time he does. Like, there is a sense of the two humans and the half elf kind of look at him warily. I mean, they're willing to take him on, but there is a sense that there is like he's not wrong in that he has to earn his place, right?
Yeah, in the sense that everyone kind of does, but his self-worth though, like if Pisces actually is as good, like could be as talented and smart and whatever as he thinks he is, then it's also kind of true of Kissimver that he really has like zero, the opposite end of the spectrum, no idea or concept of his own self-worth.
I've been thinking a little bit about it now. I think some of the most epic phrases from The Wandering Inn that's become sort of a classic for those who are caught up come from him. Like, it's just, he just grows so much in volume three, and he grows even more later on. But now we come to the person who sort of needs to grow but is stuck in a weird holding pattern, Yavlon.
So, if everyone else is sort of undergoing a character arc of coming into themselves, if Lon feels like she is in a persistent character arc of being just broken down increasingly more and more.
Her losing her hand to try to protect people, I will say that her determination is insane. It's rooted in like a lot of trauma with the loss of her original team, with her dynamics with her family and how she believes he's not worthwhile as much as her brother and sister. Like all of that, I understand it, but it is like a huge moment when she sacrifices her physical hand to save the horns. These people don't, are almost complete strangers to her, and yet, because they've chosen to be part of her team, and because she will never let another person down like that ever again, she puts her physical body through horrible torture to help them.
I have to wonder when she did that charge with the door and basically had her arms melted into slag, did she think she was walking away from that? I'm not convinced that I thought she was.
I don't think so either. I agree.
And that's just sad. And the aftermath and the realization that her arms really just can't properly be healed and are just so brittle now. It does not have like the like concentrated despair of Ryoka when Ryoka was like trapped and thought she was had lost her leg, but that's just because Ryoka packed all of that into basically one chapter, and with Evlon, it's spread out because she just keeps trying and
There's only so much trauma a person can take. That's how I think of it. If you pile on that much trauma, just functioning requires that you sort of shove it to the side and experience it in a different way. And in the end, Yvlon does find some kind of temporary solution. And again, here's a level of trust. Yvlon hates necromancers, right? And now she trusts Pisces to like restore some use of her hands. Just everything about what she did, though, is also kind of representative of the horns a little bit, right? It becomes something of a thematic thing that all of the horns sacrifice something of themselves. Syria gave up, she gave up a hand. Yavlon gave up some hands.
Kissimver also gave up a hand.
Kissimver gives up a hand. Pisces kind of gave up a lot. Like, he's.
Pisces is sacrificing something that to him, in many ways, may be even more important than his actual limbs, his pride.
Yeah, I was gonna. I have no nice way to say it, but yeah, he's giving up the layers of walls he's built up to function in the world and actually allowing people to care about him and in turn caring for them. Like, that seems like, oh, he's not giving up a physical hand or anything. No, but when somebody is essentially a pariah and has chosen to come off his little hermit cave in the mountain and join the world again, that's not small.
Yeah. And I mean, it's easy to overlook just how important the emotional and like trauma and baggage they're carrying can be. Like it sounds really easy to like talk about that in theory. Actually doing it, well, that's like trying to tell Yvonne to just get over that dead team of hers. Like it's just not that simple. But the horns are consistently my second favorite characters as a group.
Okay, yeah, sure. As an adventuring group, though, they are, you're right, they're not my favorite, now that I think about it.
Oh, as an adventuring group, they're my favorite, but like characters in the story, like as a whole, the Horns of Hammerod, I'm never unhappy to see a Horns chapter, ever.
That is true.
I love their journey. They're all just so complex. There's this found family dynamic that I really appreciate. It's just, some other characters introduced in this book are actually my favorites, and we'll get to them when we get to them.
Yeah, I will say that if Pirate had chosen to just write about the Horns and Eren and made that the focus of the series, I think I would have enjoyed it just as much as I do today. Maybe I would have missed a whole lot that was really great,
Yeah.
but I would have enjoyed it just as much. The evolution of the Horns in Volume 3 is it, this is their crucible. This is how they formed, and I loved it.
Yeah, this it was quite literally the story of the horns being forged by fire, which is a terribly insensitive to say about Yvonne, but
Yeah, well, poor Yvonne. Maybe her arms will get better someday. Okay, so that's it for me for the horns. You got anything else?
just two things that come to mind. When we're talking about the importance of the horns bonding together and the trust that they're building, I think that their relationship with Eren and Ryoka really gets highlighted in this volume when they hand over this all of this incredibly valuable, potentially like ruinously expensive risk involved in giving Ryoka all of their loot to take up to be checked out by that enchanter. And the way that, like, it's been so weird between Eren and between Ryoka and Saria, and the shit that Ryoka pulled with Yvonne, and how, like, they're coming together, but they're also building this trust outside of their group. And then they just gave Eren the door. That's and not a single one of them even really argued about it. They're all like, yeah, no, it's Eren. Eren gets the door. Eren gets what she wants. Eren is like the unofficial den mother of the Horns of Hammerod, almost. Den mother's not the right word. Founder. It's like, she signed the keelhaul plate that they slapped on that ship, even if she's not actually, on it. It's just really cool, and I think that like that dynamic as well is just as key. Although we'll have to talk about it more from Eren's end when we talk about her place in the volume.
Okay, yeah. So, thank you for listening in. That was the Horns chapters. Sorry, the Horns in Volume 3. Look forward to more from us. We'll be talking about. Actually, I don't know. What are we doing next week? I think we're done with the easy ones now.
We probably we have a guest I think for the Wistrom Days chapter that I'm hoping we can get those out actually for our next episode.
Okay, we could do Wistrom Days. And if not Wistrom Days, we can talk about Leonette and Mercia and how the two characters develop in Volume 3.
Yes, or also Ethelm. Ethelm, you know what? I've got a lisp, and pronouncing that is terrible, which is a shame because it's my favorite part of this whole story.
It took a little while for me to get it, but Esthelm.
Esthelm. Perfect. All right. Thank you for listening.
Bye, everybody!
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins.
Edited by Discanter.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter @NoKillingGoblin or email us at NoKillingGoblins with an S @gmail.com.